It's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine. That's great, it starts with an earthquake, birds, snakes, and aeroplanes. Many brutes are not afraid. I have a freaking listen to yourself, third world, with its own needs. Something in your own head, beat it up, and actually got no suit. The ladder from the clatter with the fear of fight down. Night, fire in the fire, resistance of the gang, the government for hiring the combat site. But you wasn't coming in a hurry, the security beat it down your neck. Between the border trap and Trump, pay the problems with that low plane. Fine then, upfall, overfall, find the corner, too bloody to lose. Save your devil, world, in your own need. See your heart, tell me that the river in the river was the right. You patriotic, patriotic, land, might, right, might, feeling in British life.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I feel fine.
Welcome to the Doom and Bloom Hour with medical preparedness experts Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy, your source for information on how to succeed if everything else fails. And now, your hosts, Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy.
The novelty alternative tonight, decline. It's the end of the world as we know it.
I'm Joe Alton, MD, and I'm a fellow of the American College of Surgeons, a fellow of the American College of OBGYN. Amy is?
A certified nurse midwife and an advanced registered nurse practitioner.
That's right, and together we are the founders of doomandbloom.net, and we have, gosh, over 1,000 articles, podcasts, and videos on medical preparedness. It's all about survival medicine, what to do in austere settings. We're the authors of the Book Excellence Award winner in medicine, the Survival Medicine Handbook, now in its 700-page third edition. Our latest book is Alton's Antibiotics and Infectious Disease, a Layman's Guide to Available Antibacterials in Austere Settings. And we design an entire line of medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. Oh, we're also contributors to American Survival Guide, Survivor's Edge. We have contributed to Backwoods Home.
I was just going to mention that since I just talked about it. I just got my recent issue for Backwoods Home about 2 days ago.
Yeah, that's great.
Just came in the mail. We love that magazine also.
Yes, yeah, so we're big supporters of Dave Duffy and the family.
And I love that you guys describe your credentials, and it's certainly not in an egotistical way, because people listening need to know, when it comes to a topic as important as medicine and health, that they're not dealing with, like, my cousin who, like, went to high school and took a health class and feels, you know, qualified to talk about these. When it comes to personal finance and medical stuff, those are two times credentials are really important. So you guys are listening to the real deal. Obviously, their books are amazing. Just go onto their website and get them. Well, the topic we wanted to start off with was pandemic. And I wanted to ask you guys, what is a pandemic?
You know, I get that question a lot, and a lot of people just aren't sure what the difference is between a pandemic and an epidemic. Now, both are instances where an infectious disease goes out of control. But let's start with some definitions. I need the people out there to know what we're talking about. An epidemic is a sudden and widespread outbreak, I'm reading this, of an infectious disease in a community that is not there all the time. And so influenza is a pretty good example of this. It arrives suddenly in seasonal waves. It's usually at least slightly different genetically from its predecessors. So that would qualify as an epidemic. Now, it's still influenza, but the virus, depending on what year it is and what the genetic mutations have been, viruses mutate frequently and rapidly. The virus might act more or less aggressive based on how it mutates. Now, a pandemic. Now, that occurs when an epidemic of an infectious disease runs rampant throughout a large region, or in the case of the great Spanish flu epidemic of 1918, the entire world. Another pandemic epidemic was Zika virus. Zika virus started in Asia, then it went to French Polynesia, and then I think in 2016 ended up in South America. So those were pandemic diseases. Now, if you compare this with Ebola, for example, that stayed in West Africa, and although there were some cases that ended up in other countries, including the U.S., there was no community-wide outbreak of it anywhere else. And note that both of these, both epidemic and pandemics, are different from diseases that are endemic. An endemic disease, very few people have heard of this, is a disease that's constantly found among a particular population in or in a certain area. So malaria, for example, is endemic in many tropical countries. It's not new to the area. It's always there. Cases are constantly being reported. Now, if malaria outbreaks occurred in New York City or Toronto, well, that would be an epidemic because it's not something that's usually seen there.
Yeah, and there are so many novels and even movies out there about a pandemic as a collapse, or not even a collapse, I use that word too loosely, as a really bad thing, an SHTF moment. I mean, how big of a threat is pandemic? And let's keep it limited to the United States, since almost all our listeners are in the United States, and almost all of your listeners are in the United States listening to this. You know, how big of a threat is it? Is this like a meteor strike that we kind of can disregard a little bit because it's so unlikely? Are we due for a pandemic? Might be a better way of asking this.
Well, you know, the threat of pandemic is always there. We've had all sorts of pandemics off and on just in the last decade. I'll talk a little bit about those. The thing is that it's so easy using commercial air travel these days to get people to faraway places in just a few hours. The Ebola case, for example, that ended up going from Liberia to Dallas, you know, over the course of a day, that wound up infecting two nurses in a Texas hospital. And that woke up the United States to the threat of pandemics. So it makes it less likely that we're going to be caught unawares. Before that Ebola case showed up in Dallas, we had only 19 isolation beds in the entire country that could handle a disease as deadly and contagious as Ebola was. Most hospitals have made contingency plans. Now they can convert entire wards to isolation units. So pretty much any large hospital will be able to handle a major, well, I hope, major isolation event at this point. What disease is going to be the most likely candidate to cause the next pandemic? The answer depends on the level of attention that we wind up placing on prevention. There are all sorts of pandemics in the past, the plague, typhoid, typhus, cholera, we'll talk about those later. There's still very real possibilities, especially in areas that have limited access to modern medicine. Maybe not in the U.S. so much, but, for example, after the earthquake in Haiti, there was a massive cholera pandemic. Currently in Los Angeles, the homeless over there, it's a terrible problem. They have issues with typhus. They have issues with even a couple cases, I think, of plague being found. As a matter of fact, just yesterday in China, they had a couple of cases of plague as well. So these are all some of the classic pandemic-type diseases that could easily wind up going to places like the United States. But we have now antibiotics for these bacterial diseases, we talk about them in our book a lot, that can nip infections in the bud. That decreases the risk for them, but will antibiotics be available in large enough quantities to deal with a true pandemic outbreak where communities all over the country are wind up getting attacked by this, just like the Spanish flu? You know, there was a big military buy of the antibiotic doxycycline less than a decade ago, I think it was about 8 years ago or so. And it caused such a shortage that the FDA actually put out an emergency use authorization for doxycycline tablets or capsules that were several years expired. They said you can indeed take them, they'll still be effective. This is why I wrote the first articles on fish and bird antibiotics, at least by a physician, all those years ago, because I felt the general population needed better access to these life-saving drugs and should have, every prepper out there should have a source of antibiotics. I don't sell antibiotics, but they should have a source of antibiotics. Thomas Labs is a popular distributor of these in fish and avian form.
I wanted to emphasize why this is a problem, and it's bigger, obviously, than people just getting sick. I don't mean to downplay that. You know, people would be dying from whatever the disease is, but obviously the problem is far bigger than that. You've got people that are not going to leave their homes, which makes sense, which means you're not going to have police officers going to work, which creates a bunch of problems everyone can imagine. You're going to have the water treatment facility engineers and all those other people not being able to go to work and treat water supplies. Truck drivers, I mean, they're driving around, they're interacting with people all over the place. Truck drivers would be out of their minds to get in their cab and go stop and, you know, be in 9 cities or truck stops in a day and have all this disease. So the trucks stop flowing. So as with so many prepping threats or things that can cause a collapse, it's not the actual thing that is the problem. It's all the after effects. It's all the ripples. It's the second and third order effects of people not going to work. That obviously has a huge economic impact. So that's what we're talking about. And obviously you would need to have medical information and hopefully supplies to be able to treat your own family or maybe small community from this stuff. But this is bigger than just some people down the street getting sick.
And what I'm hearing, and I'm just going to throw this out there because I know it'll help keep this conversation going, is sort of the best part of prevention of these things is the will and the I think about some of the political things that have happened in some of our past epidemics. I'm thinking of bird flu in blue. I'm thinking of honestly Ebola, and how those decisions from policymakers and leaders affected the ability to stop it and to prevent spread. And so I always think of myself, I don't want to be dependent on somebody in an office far away to keep me from being sick. So that's my prepping mindset. But I know Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy have some more thoughts on this, and we want to keep that chain of thought going. So go for it.
All right. Well, I wanted to talk about what I think might be more likely to happen. It's very possible that with some of these bacterial diseases we talked about in the last segment, that we'll be able to nip them in the bud with enough antibiotics, if we're able to produce them in the quantities that are necessary to stop a bunch of community-wide outbreaks. But I think the next pandemic is going to be viral. Ebola, that was a major epidemic in West Africa. The question is whether the organism that causes it can live outside certain climates. In other words, can Ebola take hold in places like Minnesota or Toronto, for example? You mentioned, I think, bird flu. That's a virus that could be an issue. Sudden acute respiratory syndrome, that's known as SARS. That was an issue in the Far East some years ago. In the Middle East, there was Middle East respiratory syndrome. That's a lethal disease that's related to SARS. That's a problem in Middle Eastern countries that employ Asian foreign workers, like a big issue in Saudi Arabia with people getting MERS from apparently Korean workers that go there on a regular basis. We've also had a number that have crossed the pond, the number of viral diseases that have turned into pandemics that have crossed the pond just in the last few years. There was a virus called chikungunya that was carried by mosquitoes from Africa to South America and pretty much all the tropical areas, even subtropical areas in South Florida. That ranged far and wide over the Caribbean in 2014 and 15. And that was pretty bad because it caused stomach problems and other issues. It sometimes took months to recover from. As a matter of fact, in the midst of this pandemic in the Dominican Republic, there was a 13% absentee rate throughout the entire country over a course of about a month. 13% of your workers don't get to work.
Exactly.
It rarely affects the economy.
That actually is proving out what Glenn was talking about. And I just want to mention to both of you and those listening that is actually what started Joe and I prepping 10 years ago in a serious, serious fashion. We had always been preppers. My dad was in the Air Force. His mother lived through the Depression and, you know, some problems with hunger. And so he kind of learned from her to store things away. And then through the Air Force, he learned a lot of, you know, skills that he passed on to my brother and I. And then we lived in South Florida for a long time with the threat of hurricanes. So every season, you have to get flashlights and batteries and tents and extra food and those kind of things. So we always had those things. But about 10 years ago, one of these viral problems came through, and Joe and I started thinking exactly what you said, Glenn. It's not the disease so much, and yes, people will die and get sick, it's that we won't have our society functioning as it is functioning now. The grocery stores won't get filled up, exactly like you said. The truckers won't be traveling. It's just going to shut down so many things, which will cause things to get so much worse. It won't be just about trying to get rid of the virus. It's going to be trying to get society back on its feet again.
Sure.
And even after we can control the virus, which hopefully we would be able to, it might work its way through this country and perhaps the world because of our travels. But getting back on our feet, if we've lost a lot of people, we don't have the workers, It's going to take a while. You know, we don't have the farmers. Maybe the food, the crops have died because nobody could take care of them. There's so many consequences, and it could take years and years for us to get back on our feet.
For Ebola, it was the loss of so many medical workers because of the major contagion of the virus itself. It was so virulent, it was so strong in terms of its ability to infect other people that it killed a lot of the medical workers that indeed were
trying to help others.
People, right. Right. With chikungunya, it affected workers.
Right.
And so it affected the economy that way. Then you had Zika virus in 2016, which affected newborns in Brazil, at least.
So horrible.
And that is another pandemic that was an issue. But I think the highest risk the pandemic disease is going to get us is going to be influenza. And what Stephen King calls the super flu, one that really genetically mutates, be just like the Spanish flu, and really kill a lot
person
of folks.
Person to person to person. All you have to be is kind of in the same vicinity.
Right.
And you can get it.
In 2009, the swine flu epidemic killed 200,000 people. Anything that's going to be airborne is going to be
a big issue.
And
that's going to be the thing.
And we're identifying various new influenza strains every year. So influenza is mutating rapidly, and
more
just
rapidly,
a matter of time.
More rapidly than anyone understands. I've read things where scientists have watched these. And they've seen mutations within hours. I mean, I hate to say these things are smart because they don't have brains, but somehow they're figuring out how to conquer their environment. Whatever we throw at them, they're figuring out how to get around it. So that's the issue. They want to survive. There's just some instinct in living things, including plants, that they figure out and mutate how to survive. They want to take over. The viruses have a desire somehow to take over everything and be everywhere. And this is the problem. And I don't know that we can fight them forever.
Well, here's a question. Are we due for one? Sort of like with earthquakes. Here in the Pacific Northwest, they always say a 9.0 earthquake happens about every 300 years, and we're about 50 years overdue. Are we sort of overdue for a big pandemic, or are the conditions so much different from, say, the Spanish flu of whatever 1918 or so, 100 years ago, that, you know, maybe pandemics aren't as big of a deal? I mean, are we due for one? What do you guys think?
I think we're worse off. I think the fact that they weren't able to fly across the entire world from one side to the other in, you know, less than a day. If somebody gets on a plane full of 300 people who didn't realize they had just been exposed hours earlier, and this virus starts shedding into the air systems and just people around them, even if they have good scrubbers on those airplanes that get rid of viruses, just the people around them, and then those people a few hours later start shedding some virus, that entire plane may disembark and nobody even knows they're sick yet, and then they go off, those 300 people. I think we're so much worse. In the Spanish flu, it traveled because of people moving from town to town. So it would go to a town and then it would go to another town. This time, we can literally spread this throughout the entire world, I feel, within a few days. Honestly, if it was really, really contagious,
it will
not take long. And then we will be so overwhelmed. The hospitals will be overwhelmed. We will not have enough medicine in many, many places in the world. The government might have it, but the rest of us folks won't. And the hospitals are going to be overwhelmed, and we're all going to be stuck at home. I think we're much worse off now.
And that's why I think it's going to be viral, because we have now great antibiotics that can handle a lot of different bacterial issues, including a lot of the diseases that were pandemic in the past. But we still are in the infancy of dealing with viruses with medicines.
I know. We can't even cure the common cold.
That's right.
You know, and it seems so simple, but it's complicated.
And that's why the Spanish flu was such a big issue back then. They didn't have antibiotics back then, but they also didn't have antivirals. And there was nothing that really stopped the flu from spreading.
And how much Tamiflu are we really going to have? And most countries don't have stockpiles. And even our country who has stockpiles, you know who's going to get it? The politicians. Those are who are going to get it. The ones that are down in the bunkers are going to get the Tamiflu, not us up here.
But you don't feel strongly.
On the surface.
But you don't feel strongly about it.
I feel very strongly about it. Don't get me started. I actually personally wrote to the CEO of the company, I don't remember the pharmaceutical company, who produces Tamiflu, an angry letter. In fact, I'm surprised people in black suits didn't show up in front of my house, telling him that they need to up their production of Tamiflu because I know his family's going to live, but the rest of us are going to end up dying if you don't get this out. This was 10 years ago. Nobody showed up yet, but, you know.
Well, and you just, Nurse Amy, you just hit the nerve that I touched on a little bit as we came into this segment of the show, and we got lots of time to talk about this. Lights me up about this very issue is because the health of the general population during times of these epidemics that we've seen in the news in the last 10 to 15 years becomes a political issue. I remember when you hit it, the SARS flu was going around, and how the political culture at the time, I'll say this, limited air travel because of what you just spoke about. Flights were canceled because the movement of people spread this disease. And everybody got inconvenienced and it was not cool and people got mad. But you know what? It kept that disease from being worse than it was. So I remember that happening. Now, did it happen as much as it should? That's for others to decide. What really took me was a few years ago when the Ebola crisis was going on and our politicians, you just said it, in charge, were like, hey, we're not shutting down flights, we're going to let people come and move and go into the United States, out of the United States, to and from these countries from this disease that you don't even know you have it. And then within hours, you are suddenly bleeding internally, uncontrollably. And that's what frustrates me, is that we have people who are politically motivated making health decisions for innocent people because of these things. And so that's when I say to myself, I am not going to let these sorts of people be in charge of my health. I will control my movements. I will control who comes into my environment. And if somebody from West Africa, like, this is never going to happen, if somebody from West Africa during an outbreak of Ebola, they're going to be told to leave very quickly and very forcefully. Because of that, I get to control that. But we also, this is what I love about you guys, is that, all right, if they're going to, this is our time now to stockpile things like what you just said. Tamiflu is so important. We need to be in charge of our health now, and we have the opportunity, before things get really crazy, to stockpile our own personal stash so that we aren't dependent on a government or on a CEO of a company to provide this for us. And so I wanted to see what your thoughts are. I do want to talk about the homeless crisis, because I think that's another version of this. We have policymakers who are making really weak decisions in how to take care of the homeless crisis, but we have cholera and typhus and TB now spreading through big city communities that are extremely contagious and extremely deadly, and they're taking a very weak stance on the seriousness of this. So I'm going to just let you pick any one of those topics. Thank you, Nurse Amy, for lighting me on fire over here, but I'd like to know your thoughts on that, because I think that's the current conditions we're in, right?
You're absolutely right, and I'm going to let Joe talk about that in just a second, but I do want to tell you that I was so fired up when they were allowing these flights to come in and out of these countries that they knew just was loaded with this problem, loaded with it. And they still allowed it. It infuriated me. So, you know, I have no problem shutting down the airplanes. I'm sorry if it's inconvenient for people who want to fly from the, you know, pandemic area to our country. But sorry, folks, we need to protect our citizens. And I would like to see more of that happen if we have something that's seriously contagious.
This is very, very controversial. I wrote an article specifically advocating a travel ban from the West African countries that had Ebola.
Yeah, I remember that.
Back then. And I'll tell you, it didn't sit well with some people. I lost 300 followers on Twitter. I'm not kidding.
You know what? Good riddance.
But that's the thing. That it's somehow unreasonable.
Well, let the little flowers go wilt away somewhere else. Okay. All right, let's talk about the homeless problem. This is a big, big problem. And they can't get their you-know-what together over there. But
yeah, you know, about 40% of the people in California live below the poverty line. And there are more and more homeless, it seems, every day over there. And we traveled to Los Angeles for a talk a few years ago.
We've been there a couple times. We took a wrong turn
and ended up in a homeless, I don't know, village.
It was before there were iPhones and GPS. It was many years ago. But three of the kids were under 18. They were young, and two of them were just a little bit over that. But I have five kids in the back of this SUV. I don't really know where I'm going. We don't have GPSs. We have maps. Okay, you guys remember maps? So I turned the wrong way into the heart of the worst area in LA that you could possibly imagine. There were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of homeless people, but they were like 10 deep in the sidewalks on both sides. And they're looking at this woman who does not belong in that area. And they were eyeing us, and it was very scary. And it was that bad 18 years ago.
It was, wow, is it that
yeah, long? It was like my maybe goodness. Just before we got
can
married.
Can you imagine what it's like now?
Yeah, but it was bad back then. So I can't imagine what's happening now.
Well, I mean, what's happening now is that some of the old-time classic infectious diseases that caused so many deaths in the past are because of poor sanitation and poor hygiene showing up in and among the homeless population in Los Angeles. And I'm sure also it's a problem in San Francisco, although I haven't read much about that, but I guarantee you that it is a problem in the big cities all over California. And cholera is one of them. That's something that has happened, that is, there have been a couple of cases of that. Typhus.
Well, I think how to prep for them, because as I understand it, and if I'm wrong, go ahead and, you know, gently tell me so, but there are some very easy to prepare for things here. Antidiarrheals, maybe pills, anti-mucus sorts of things. They may not absolutely treat somebody who has cholera, but it could lessen effects. And then, of course, having clean water and clean food and everything, that's a given. But yeah, how to prep for it? Because my approach to this is there are some easy, inexpensive ways to prepare for this that will do you a whole lot of good and for not a lot of money and not a lot of time, and it doesn't take up storage space and all those kind of things. So
you got it. Well, you know, besides having a good supply of antibiotics, for example, to deal with some of these classic bacterial diseases that we described in Alton's Antibiotics and Infectious Disease, you just need a brain, basically, to get started planning out an epidemic sick room. I think that anybody that can start by just thinking about the possibility of an epidemic, accepting that it can happen, and that they may need to take measures for it, I mean, I think that's a great first step. Whether it's in a tent, in a bug-out location, or a room in their house, that doesn't mean that I expect to come to your place tomorrow and see it all set up. I mean, just that you have a strategy together and begin to accumulate the supplies. In outbreaks of infectious disease, the challenge for the medic is healing the sick while preventing contagion in the healthy, right? So to succeed, a sick room has to be chosen as the place where the infected can rest and recover while not being in contact with those that are not ill. It should be possible to put together a sick room that will minimize the chance of infectious disease running rampant throughout the entire family or a survival group if you're bugging out. The sick room, very simple, should be away from the common areas. It should be not near where food is being prepared. It should not be in the family room or near the family room where people are gathered. But it should be well lit, should have good ventilation. Good lighting is going to make it easier for the medic to monitor physical signs. The ventilation helps decrease the concentration of bacteria and other pathogens in the air, so that's really important. And you need to have a door or other barrier, even if it's just plastic sheeting. That is something that's very important to separate the sick from the healthy. And depending on the total space that's involved, you want to keep the sick room as far away from your daily traffic as you can. And the furnishings in it, very simple, minimalist, a work surface, an exam area, bed spaces, no fabric surfaces, no carpets. These are things that can harbor pathogens or disease-causing organisms and should be avoided if at all possible. And even bedding might be best be covered in plastic if you're in a truly bad situation with a really contagious
That's
disease.
That's what I was just going to say. Hard surfaces, like hard tables, and then wrap all your bedding and pillows, anything that might absorb things with plastic. There's all kinds, even at Walmart has plastic bedding that's waterproof. And the allergy ones that you can zip up, some of those are waterproof also. So you can zip the entire mattress. So keep any kind of fabrics away. Even if you're going to use blankets, try to use 100% cotton so you can throw a little bleach in the hot water when you're washing them.
right? You also have to have a way to eliminate waste products from people that are sick. In most cases, just immersing the waste in a container with some bleach, that may be sufficient. But for extremely contagious diseases, some actually suggest burning this stuff. And, well, I don't know if that's going to be necessary. It just depends on just how bad things are. Now, I will tell you the items that you're going to need. I want you to have disinfectants, like household bleach, rubbing alcohol, tincture of iodine. These are things that are important. I want you to have buckets that you can remove this waste from and other trash that needs to be disposed of that might be infected. You need a work table and a chair. You need some bedding. You need utensils that are dedicated specifically for those that are sick. Plastic sheeting I just mentioned. And you should have a hand basin with soap and hand sanitizers and personal protection gear. That's very important. Personal protection gear and maybe biohazard bags. Our personal protection gear kit has biohazard bags in it. And so it's something that I think is very important. So what I want you to do is right outside the barrier that you have put together, I want a station with masks, gloves, gowns, aprons, disinfecting materials. This is going to be something that's going to be very important. You don't want to start protecting yourself, putting on protection gear after you've gotten into the room with the sick person. You want to have that on beforehand. So a basin with water, soap, other disinfectant, towels that should be kept for exclusive use by the caregiver. And by the way, with regards to the caregiver, there should be only one person involved in caring for the sick, if at all possible. You don't want too many people exposed because that increases the likelihood that somebody's going to get sick. One interesting item that people don't think about with regards to putting together a sick room is just to simply have a noisemaker, like a whistle or something like that. Many sick patients are just too weak to call out, and a noisemaker of some sort is going to allow you to know when you're needed. It also gives some assurance to in the sick room that they're not ignoring, though you can't always be in the room with them. As a matter of fact, probably not a good idea to be always in the room with them.
You know, I'm going to add one more thing that we've talked about in the past that you don't really think is a prepping item, is a UV light. Now, they have a couple of companies make them with batteries. So, you know, we think, oh, well, you might not have electricity. But most people are going to be storing batteries. Now, these UV lights tend to be marketed for bed bugs, and they're small ones that you can put in your luggage and take with you to your hotel room and
battery powered.
Spend an hour.
There's some batteries that are battery powered. You can use it on a plane.
That's what I'm saying. You use it on a plane, you know, and they might be maybe only like 12 inches long. And then there's bigger ones. We also have two bigger ones that are maybe about 20 inches long that have a much larger UV light.
Dr. Bones, feel free to jump in. You're the one that gets to, if your voice is going, we totally want to respect that. So, yeah.
You know what? We'll just continue on with the supplies for this particular thing. And then when we're finished with those, you know, we'll let you know.
Okay.
That's the supplies.
Perfect.
We'll just talk until we finish with supplies because I know you have more. There's actually been some good scientific studies done with UV lights. Not only killing viruses, but actually sterilizing instruments. That's how good and effective they are. So when I think of preps for a room that would have, you know, nasty viruses floating around, I think having that portable ultraviolet light would be something really, really helpful. Of course, you don't want to hold it, you know, 20 inches above the surface. You're going to need to get nice and close to the surface to actually do good. So having a portable battery-powered ultraviolet light, again, they do sell them under the bed bug.
In wands.
And it's called a wand. It's called a UV wand.
UVC
wand. UVC wand, I'm sorry. And another thing that I would think about, if you did have some access to electricity, let's say, you know, the whole world is not collapsed yet, in the words of Glenn, collapsed, but you do have some electricity, also consider having air purifiers, not necessarily with the HEPA filters, but go for the ones with the UV lights in them. Again, if you have those circulating in the room with the people who are sick, it might cut down on the load in the air and decrease the risk of the healthcare worker who's coming in. Plus, it might move a little air because you don't want stale air. We talk about barriers for these rooms, but that doesn't mean you're duct taping the windows, folks. The person still needs some fresh air. We're not trying to suffocate them okay, they still need some fresh air. You're trying to keep the barrier between sick people and healthy people. But if they're in a room, open up the windows, they need fresh air. But that filter might help also.
Interestingly enough, you should consider duct taping the vents.
Yes.
That go to other rooms in the house in order to decrease the viral load that goes through those vents to the rest of the folks in the house. I just wanted to mention that with regards to the UVC-1, I mean, a lot of people will look at it and say, oh, that doesn't really work. Well, in the Journal of Wilderness and Environmental Medicine, they took instruments that were dirty, that needed to be cleaned. They put them in a soup of essentially 7 different bacteria, and then they hung them up with hangers, with coat hangers, and they passed the UV wand after cleaning them with something called HibaCleanse, which is a good antiseptic. So using an antiseptic called HibaCleanse, and then passing a UVC wand over them and around them for about 45 seconds, actually cut down the amount of bacteria on the instruments by 100%. In other words, there was no visible bacteria seen when they evaluated it afterwards.
Yeah, and that's the kind of practical stuff, you know, that we love having you guys on for. By the way, you were describing a sick room, and one of the shows we were on, RV Prepper, we talked about the use of recreational vehicles as quarantine zones. Now, the downside of that is most have fabric, and you were talking about hard surfaces, so it would not do well in that category. But as far as being a shelter that is completely isolated from the rest of the house or office or building or whatever it is, you know, there's that. And so that might be a thing. And there are a lot of RVs out there that are inexpensive, and maybe they you know, they're not really towable, but you've got a little shelter, it could work for that. So there's that. Consider RVs.
Yeah, that's a good idea. The way that people die from most of these diseases, most of these pandemic type diseases, interestingly enough, is from dehydration due to extreme nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, sometimes bleeding. This is something that we saw in Ebola, that the Ebola death rate at the beginning of the epidemic there in 2014 was about 65%. It dropped to about 40%. I think that the reason for that was because they were able to hydrate people, and they didn't have the ability to hydrate people. Of course, most preppers aren't going to have access to IV hydration because intravenous fluids, even just normal saline, salt water, is by prescription. But it's important to have some oral rehydration salts. You can see some on Amy's store, or to make your own oral rehydration solution at home. You can easily do that with each liter of water, 6 to 8 teaspoons of sugar, 1 to 1.5 to 1 teaspoon of salt, 1/4 or 1/2 teaspoon of salt substitute for the potassium in it. You can find salt substitute by the salt in the supermarket, and maybe a pinch of sodium bicarbonate. And if you have flavoring, that also would be fine to add that. And you add that to 1 liter of water. Now, if you're rehydrating a child or an infant, I want you to put this mixture in 2 liters of water. In my opinion, it's going to be bad water and contaminated food that's going to cause the majority of the deaths that are not associated with hostile intentions in survival settings.
Yeah, and once again, this is a practical, low-cost thing, and as much as I love guns, getting that 7th AR-15 is not going to help you get through a pandemic, right? Am I right?
If you're an octopus.
Yeah.
So if somebody, you've mentioned UV lights, and you've mentioned, you know, oral IV sorts of things, electrolytes, if that's what I would call them. If somebody is taking a list here and they're going to go to Costco or Sam's Club, I guess they're different things in different parts of the country, what's a shopping list people should put together for basically being as pandemic ready as possible, especially with some of the things like the hydration and the simple stuff that you guys mentioned?
Let's see. I'm envisioning ourselves walking into Costco with our giant, enormous cart that they have. I would get tarps. They have good prices on tarps, and I think they have them more than one to a pack. I would get tons of batteries, lighting. They have those press-on lights, like for closets, that you don't need to hook up to electricity, and you could stick those anywhere. You could add extra lighting, say, to that RV that you had that you couldn't plug in, but you needed some extra light. So lighting, including flashlights, any kind of lanterns they have. I would tend to stay away from the kerosene type lamps and go for the batteries. Make sure they do have rechargeable batteries. They're more expensive, unfortunately. So I would go for the rechargeables and make sure you get the recharger. Let's see. I believe they have marine batteries there. So I am a big proponent of solar panels. Every once in a while, you'll find some solar panels there. I know Goal Zero had a special once, and they had all of their products, and I just went insane there buying all of that.
So did I, Amy. Yeah. So did I, Amy. It was it was crazy. It was awesome. But you think deep cycle marine batteries there and putting a battery bank together and a solar system is much easier than you think. It's the University of YouTube, and I hold a master's degree from the University of YouTube, so I feel pretty good about myself.
Hey,
I keep going with the Costco. Yes.
We're talking about Costco. Don't forget to get lots of loperamide or Imodium as an anti-diarrheal. Bleach, you can get that 8 drops per gallon in water. Double it if the water is very cloudy or very suspicious for being bad. If it's 6% bleach, if it's 8.25% bleach, just 6 drops per gallon would be appropriate. And
big things of baking soda.
I don't know, do they have pool shock?
I don't think they've ever had.
They do on it's seasonal, and I looked at that. Golly, we're tracking. It's so crazy. We have like the same brains. Well, you know more stuff than I do about this stuff. But anyway, pool shock, and it was like $70 for pounds of pool shock. And I looked at the thing, and pool shock is basically pool chlorine stuff to make basically bleach and then to treat water. And I looked at it and I said, whoa, I don't think this has ever happened before. That's too much stuff for me to buy, which I don't say very often when it comes to prepping supplies. But yeah, pool shock, you can get on Amazon a 1 pound thing of it, and you put it in a little bit of water and it makes bleach, and then you can treat stuff. You can treat instruments. Right. You could, you know, wash clothing. You can treat water. You can't have enough bleach. And one of the things about, and correct me if I'm wrong, guys, liquid bleach, I don't think it expires, but it loses its effectiveness after a while. So you need to rotate it. But pool shock powder would not be the same, because pool shock powder is basically powdered bleach, if you will.
You're right. Let me give you the formula that you can use. So pool shock is calcium hypochlorite. Household bleach is sodium hypochlorite. So it is a little bit different than using, of course, just regular bleach to try to help disinfect water. What you need to do with pool shock is you dissolve 1 heaping teaspoon of the granules. That's about 1/4 ounce in 2 gallons of water, and that makes, I'm going to call it bleach, but let's call it it's a chlorine solution. And that is what you're going to use to disinfect water. And to disinfect water, you take that mixture, you add 1 pint of that solution to about every 12.5 gallons of water, and that disinfects it. It equals to about 1 part of this solution that you just made to 100 parts of water. And if you want to remove the chlorine odor, just pour it back and forth from one clean container to another. Wait at least 30 minutes before drinking so that it can work its magic.
All right.
And that's, by the way, not just my opinion. That's from water.epa.gov.
All right. So let's go back to our Costco fun shopping day. I would also, and this is something people would probably skip at the beginning, is you see all those office supplies. We were talking about whiteboards earlier, and I would grab some whiteboards. Not only can you document the person's, let's say, vital signs and their symptoms, but you can have plans. You know, when did the person eat? What was their input? What was their output, which is what they're drinking and what's coming out? You know, to be able to have this signage on the outside, you could also put this on the inside. If you don't necessarily want to walk into the room, the person could write something to you and erase it as a message. I'm hungry. Soup, please. Can I have more water? So that you don't constantly have to be going in there, having the person talk to you, which then, of course, exhales viruses into the air, and then you speak to them, and maybe you're inhaling something. So whiteboards, markers, pen and paper, and pencils, things that the person, you know, if they want to draw or do, I don't know, write something, give them something to do. A deck of cards would be good for you know, again, keep their brain occupied. And then, of course, filing stuff, because you need to keep files on what's going on with the person. As if you were a hospital, because this is a patient. And if you have more than one healthcare worker, you need to communicate what's going on with this person so that everyone is on the same page when they come to take over the shift of taking care of that person. So I think a lot of people forget about hospital filing things and occupying the person's brain. So again, little games, things that maybe have plastic pieces that can be washed, plastic covered, playing cards, so those kind of things. And then of course, when you round around to the medicine, I would basically get almost like one of everything. You know, you're getting your Tylenol, you're getting your ibuprofen, you're getting your Imodium. Maybe somebody might need a stool softener someday. So you just really kind of clean out the medicine area in Costco. You can never have too much. I would just have to say that.
So I love how we've gone from pandemics to whiteboards, but it's still the same thing. It's like whiteboards in a pandemic by Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy, right? But it makes total sense. Another example of prepping 2.0 in the sense of that next level. Not only are you just having enough MREs and, you know, AK-47s, you're now, you've got a whiteboard so you can treat people and you can have rotating healthcare workers and all of this other stuff. This is precisely why you guys are on the show, is because it is that next level and it's so easy to prepare for. Everything we're talking about is low cost and, you know, just do it. I love the shopping list. Anything else on the shopping list besides, speaking of seasonal things, their pumpkin pies with like three cans of whipped cream are absolutely amazing. Apparently portion control is like a thing that needs to be considered, but not really when it comes to pumpkin pie. But, you know, anything else at Costco?
Well, I mean, besides all the medical supplies, I mean, literally you should just get a ton. They have gauze, they have Band-Aids, they have so much. You need to just get medical supplies. You can never, ever have enough. I want to mention
first that if what they can't get there, they can get from you at store.doomandbloom.net.
Oh, you're sweet, honey. Thank you. For food-wise.
Shameless plug.
I know. He's so sweet. You know, get a chicken noodle soup. Hey, what works with people who have viruses? We all know mom's recipe, chicken noodle soup. You might not be able to have some chickens running around your area, but you can have some canned chicken noodle soup. Crackers definitely are something I stock up a lot on. You know, those kind of canned goods, the proteins, you know, I'm sure you've gone over food before, but Costco is awesome.
Yeah, and there's more than pumpkin pie there, apparently.
Yeah.
Pumpkin pie.
It is November when we're recording this, so maybe it's on my mind. Any other thoughts you guys have? This has been fantastic.
Well, I've got to say that you just have to have a plan of action. And, you know, everybody's got the beans, everybody's got the bullets, but you know what? All that's not going to be worth a hill of beans, and you just got to shoot yourself in the foot if you don't have the bandages. So, for goodness sake, have medical supplies for pandemics, of course. You're going to want to have personal protection gear. You want to have N95 masks, you want to have gowns, you want to have aprons.
Oh, yeah, we didn't even talk about that, biohazard stuff.
Right, exactly. You want to have gloves. Nitrile gloves are the best type of gloves. There's a big epidemic of latex allergies in this country, and so therefore, I think nitrile would be better, be hypoallergenic, and most people should have a good supply of those. If you believe that a pandemic is going to be the event that causes society to unravel, well, you better have lots of gloves, lots and lots of gloves, as well as gowns and aprons and masks.
Now, speaking of masks, just a real quick hint for everyone. The surgical masks, which are the ones that look usually blue or green, and they'll either tie behind the ears or they might have elastic, those are the really cheap ones. You can get a ton of those for not much money. Those are the ones you want to use on the sick person who is coughing. It will physically stop the saliva or the cough droplets from being thrown across the room, or a sneeze even. So if you're going to go into the room, make sure that the person who is sick puts on the surgical mask before you walk in. Just just while you're in there, they can take it off after you leave. You will put on the N95, also called a respirator. That filters out anything that might escape from the person or who that might have been floating in the air prior from you breathing it in. So it's your protection from inhaling anything, and you make sure it is fit properly. There's usually a metal strip across the nose. You want to pinch that so it's tight on the nose. You want to make sure that the mask is across your cheeks, not puffed out. And also underneath your chin, even into your neck. And when you breathe in, test it before you go in the patient's room. The cheeks of the mask should suck in a little bit.
Right.
It should not be easy for you to inhale because you want to make sure the air is going through the mask and not through a side area that is not attached to your skin tightly.
We go through how to put a mask on appropriately and plus how to don and how to doff all personal protection gear in Alton's antibiotics and infectious disease.
Exactly. It's not an easy procedure, and this is partially the reason why the nurses got sick in Texas.
Yeah, they had very lax protocols.
Because they did not know how to put on and take off these items without contaminating themselves.
But we learned from our mistakes.
Yes,
luckily, these nurses are healthy today.
No, that's great. And I think you guys, and if I'm wrong, I'm going to feel like a dope here. You guys have some YouTube videos up too, and is that another way people could learn some of this stuff?
Oh yeah, absolutely. We have the Dr. Bones, Dr. Bones, Nurse Amy channel, and we have lucky to have
I think
a
YouTube
lot of
is
followers,
just Dr. Bones podcast. I think it's our email.
No, but if you go to Dr. Bones, Nurse Amy,
it'll show
Nurse
up.
Nurse Amy,
I know it
you're
does
the,
show
you're
up.
The star. I'm just the pretty face.
They just
here.
Used our email when I did the special URL for it. But, yeah, if you look up Doom and Bloom or you look up Dr. Bones podcast or you look up Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy, any of those will go to the YouTube channel.
Right.
We,
so
have lots
lot of,
and lots of, a lot right. of demonstration. I have at least three different, maybe four. I think I have four different tourniquet videos. So depending on you're not sure what tourniquet you want to get, I tell you everything. I'm not a person who can do a two-minute video in case you – can tell how long I like to talk. I have too much but when I do a tourniquet video, don't expect to sit there for 2 minutes. Expect to sit there for 10 to 15 minutes because I'm going to tell you everything and I'm going to show you how to put it on yourself and someone else and all the parts and why those parts are there and what they're doing. And there's also a great video for anyone who's considering tourniquets, the 10 critical principles of tourniquet use, and the 10 is the number 10, not written out.
Yeah, so we've got over 200.
That
videos.
One is really important. No matter what tourniquet you want, that is the video you need to watch because there are good ways and bad ways to put on and use a tourniquet. And, you know, do I loosen it? No, you don't loosen it. But I talk about all that in the video.
You know, and another reason to have community, which is one of our big prepping 2.0 topics, is hopefully there'll be some, you know, a nurse or two or somebody else who knows what they're doing. Don't rely on that, by the way. Learn it yourself. Watch you guys' videos, right? And then learn it yourself. But another reason to have community is to have people, enough people, especially specialized people or semi-specialized people, as the case may be, to take care of the sick. And by the way, if you're concerned about the caregiver getting infected, there's probably going to be a bunch of prisoners, and that's what they get to do. They get to go take care of the infected, and if they die, who cares? And yeah, I said that. I said that out loud. And it's on the after show. It's on the after show, so you know what I mean? But maybe it's a bad idea entrusting a vulnerable person to a prisoner. That's probably a terrible idea. So maybe don't do that. But no, it emphasizes the need for community in the sense of having lots of people who can do stuff who are trusted and vetted. But hey, I mean, don't count on that. I mean, that's what we're all about is adapting and preparing for austere conditions. And don't count on having like you two like living next to you, right? I mean, that would be pretty cool. I think you guys would be fun at a barbecue too with cocktails and all kinds of stuff. I think you guys would be very fun to have live next door. But anyway.
Oh, you're funny. I tell you, if there was a film crew in this this house of ours, everyone would be quite entertained.
That's so
and
true.
Yes, at a barbecue, as long as you give me a couple margaritas, we're good to go.
I thought that might be the case. Well, good. Well, hey, you guys have anything to add? And if not, you know, we've really enjoyed having you. We've learned something. Our listeners will learn something, especially here in the after show where it came down to like shopping lists and everything like that. I bet our Patreons in the comments about this show will say things like they said about our previous guest, about how helpful it is. So anything to add, and then we'll let you guys go. And we're going to, by the way, listeners, Shelby and I are going to have a spot we're going to do on a topic called Is It Just Us? And we're talking about, are we the only ones that think something bad's coming because we think America's messed up and we're sort of almost hoping for it? And because we're being really rational, we're testing ourselves. We're not just going to, you know, float along with emotion. You know, we're going to critically question our own emotions. And it's a pretty cool topic, but we'll do that in studio without the Skype connection. So anyway, that's still coming up. But anything you guys would like to add, Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy?
Just basically a big thank you for having us on your show. And we're going to make sure that as many people as possible wind up getting medically prepared. Our mission is very simple, to put a medically prepared person in every family.
Absolutely. I just want to mention, you were talking about having a lot of folks. Make sure everyone cross-trains. I think people get so isolated in certain topics. You know, someone says, oh, I'm the tactical guy. Well, you know what? The tactical guy needs to learn how to plant some garden seeds too. And, you know, and how often it needs to be watered and what the diseases are on that plant so he can grow food. So everyone cross-train. Make sure you're not just isolating yourself with one particular topic. I think you guys are really great. You've got a broad sense of all the different things. This is how Dr. Bones and I are. We've learned, we've got our ham radio licenses. We've done the solar. We just go for every topic and practice, everyone. And if you're interested in how to stop bleeding, we have lots and lots of information on YouTube. And it's a good thing for anyone who is into that tactical area to learn how to stop bleeding from the bullet that might come out of their gun.
Oh, and if I can add to that, Nurse Amy, I totally agree. Glenn and I have taken a basic stop the bleed course, and we have, I don't know, a dozen tourniquets in on our property for that very reason. And we took that class, and it's still not enough. So totally agree. And I'm going to just put it out there. I'm going to see if down the road we can have you come on and talk more about that kind of thing, that emergency sort of first. I always say this. You are your first responder. The 12-minute, 30-minute, potentially long wait for the person to come help you is can be a life changer. And that's in prison conditions. That's not even a collapse situation, how you can be a help to someone now. And I know I just opened up a topic, so I'm not going to – we won't. But I'd love to have you on, because that's the what we're seeing in our headlines. That's the mass shooting. There's been a catastrophe. There's been the car accident. You could be a lifesaver now. So right. We'll have you on later for that if that sounds good.
No, that sounds wonderful. That is another thing that I'm absolutely passionate about. And we would love to. We are certified stop the bleed instructors also. But we go past that because we know that there may be situations where you're not just stopping it when the ambulance comes, but you have to stop it and now you have to take care of it. So we can not only talk about the emergent modern medicine still exists, but going further than that, where the modern medicine doesn't exist. So we can delve deeper into that topic too. But we'd love to come back. Thank you so much.
Oh, heck yeah. We're going to love having you back. And if you're ever in our area, we're going to drink some margaritas because that's pretty good stuff. Well, thank you guys. Thank you for the time. And thank you for letting us be on your show. We loved having you on our show. And we'll stay in touch for sure.
All right, have a great day. You guys be safe. Hi, I'm Joe Alden, MD of www.doomandbloom.net, where you'll find over 600 posts, videos, and podcasts on medical preparedness. Along with my wife, nurse practitioner Amy Alden, we're the authors of the Amazon bestseller, The Survival Medicine Handbook, with over 200 five-star reviews. A disaster can strike at any time, and the ambulance may not always be heading in your direction. We've got an entire line of medical kits, supplies, and educational resources that can help you deal with injuries and illness in everything from a wilderness hike to the aftermath of a major disaster. Check them out at our shop at store.doomandbloom.net. In a disaster, you'll be glad you did.